Thank you.
Item within the Human Services, Health and Human Services.
Hi, anyway.
And we'll do this one second then, okay? Okay, good afternoon and welcome to the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee for Monday, May 13th. And we have three bills up today, four public hearings, and we have four work sessions. So, pretty busy day. We'll go ahead and get started with a public hearing on House Bill 3364A. And Beth, if you can provide us with an overview.
Madam Chair and committee members, House Bill 3364A, there's a no revenue and a minimal fiscal impact on the bill. It establishes the Integrated Pest Management Coordinating Committee and directs the committee to prepare a biennial report to the Interim Committee of the Legislature on State Agency and Public University IPM programs. Declares an emergency effective on passage.
Great, thank you. And we have Representative Kinnegar, my representative, and Senator Edwards here, and a guest. So whoever wants to go first.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm very honored to be testifying in front of my own senator here. I am Alyssa Kinnegar from House District 46, which is parts of southeast and northeast Portland. And I'm honored here to be introducing House Bill 3364, State Integrated Pest Management. This is science-based legislation that received unanimous support from the House Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources and passed the House floor 51-9. It creates a coordinated and collaborative approach to reduce pests while protecting our natural resources, our traded sector products, and human health, using the latest methods and approaches to integrated pest management, better known as IPM. The bill applies to state agencies and programs only, and not to private or commercial pest control activities. State agencies are responsible for managing pests, such as mosquitoes, rodents, and invasive plants. They need to apply state-of-the-art science approaches to protect precious habitats, rights of way, farmland, and waterways. A number of agency programs apply excellent pest management approaches. However, a survey conducted in 2010 at the request of the House Committee revealed that agencies have fallen behind in training, in coordinating their efforts, in adoption of the latest technologies, and in evaluating and reporting their outcomes. House Bill 3364 has a very small fiscal because agencies already devote resources to dealing with pests. Thus, it did not go to Ways and Means. The OSU School of Agriculture, which is the national leader in IPM, has pledged $25,000 to assist with training and technology. This is appropriate because the state IPM coordinator, Paul Jepson, to my left here, a position assigned by the USDA, is a faculty member there. OSU's program will help agencies coordinate their IPM activities, share effective methods, and learn from each other and from OSU's research by establishing common outcome metrics and processes that encourage interagency sharing of information. HB 3364 should improve efficiency and save money. HB 3364 was amended by a consensus process that involved many state agencies, including Oregon Departments of Agriculture, Forestry, State Lands, Transportation, and Administrative Services, and the Governor's Office, Gabriella Goldfarb, who did a fabulous job in coordinating this process. Paul Jepson is the IPM coordinator at OSU, the Invasive Species Council, and over 30 community and environmental groups, such as Beyond Toxics, as well as organizations representing agricultural and forestry interests, primarily Oregonians for Food and Shelter. This bill makes sure that we're protecting commodity crops, ecosystems, water quality, and public health, particularly the health of vulnerable Oregonians, such as children and the elderly. So before I turn it over to Senator Edwards, I just wanted to say that this bill went through 11 different versions before its original gut and stuff. So there's just been huge cooperation by a number of different stakeholders to get it where it is today. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Senator?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Chris Edwards. I'm a state senator from Eugene and Junction City. And first of all, I would like to start by thanking Representative Kinnegar for all the hard work that she has done to get the bill to this, to its current and I think perfect status. That's what I'm hearing. So I'll give you a brief history about my involvement with this bill and with the effort. In the interim, I became interested in reintroducing a bill on IPM for state facilities. Well, you quickly get into the definition of what's a state facility, what definition of IPM should we use, and it gets really complicated really quickly, and it starts to run into some of the same problems we had in previous legislative sessions, like an enormous fiscal impact. So in working with Beyond Toxics, we came up with a few different ideas. I had my own legislative concept drafted, which I did not end up submitting, deferred to Representative Kenny Geyer's leadership on the issue. She's worked it on the House side, has worked with all the stakeholders that she just listed, has done a marvelous job, and has come up with, I think, what is a more elegant approach to the issue. And I think that elegance is reflected in the broad support for the bill. I would just note that part of the bill that I particularly like is the introduction not only of establishing the state IPM coordinator and the IPM coordinating committee, but that committee will establish performance metrics. And so they can be, so that committee can really work with agencies about progress toward meeting IPM goals that they establish. So I think it's an elegant way to get some forward movement on an issue that I do think is quite important. And you know, since my involvement with because of my involvement with this bill, I myself was more mindful this last week when becoming aware of a little pest problem in my own home. And this weekend, I spent, instead of spraying insecticide all around the perimeter of my house, I went and I removed material that was sloughed up against the side of the house in one part and everything, and found a nest and stuff, you know. And so instead of having to, you know, I mean, and that's kind of what, that's at the most basic level, that's part of what integrated pest management is about. So anyway, that's a little bit about my involvement with the bill. I look forward to helping Representative Kenny Geyer get this bill through the Senate. And I did note that I'm not signed on yet, but I will be signing on to the bill this afternoon. So
thank you. Do you have any questions for the representative or senator before we go to Mr. Jepson's testimony? Senator Hansel.
I was just curious how the state noxious weed program would fall into the proposal. And also then virtually all counties based upon state law have a noxious weed district, noxious weed program. And curious of how that would affect them.
Is someone from Department of Ag?
Yeah, that might be a question, Department of Ag. I see Lisa in the back, so we might have to ask her to come up afterwards and answer that.
There. Okay. Yep. There is a lot of technical expertise in this room.
Do you want to go ahead and introduce yourself, and why don't you go into your testimony and see if you can
answer
that? I've
got another hearing that another committee that I should be a part of, so I'm thinking, I've seen his presentation, it's fabulous, but I'm thinking that if you don't.
So you can hold on to that question, we'll make sure that gets addressed.
We'll just keep Chris here.
Any other questions for the representative before we let her go?
Oh, not representative,
okay.
Senator.
Or the senator. I think there's one for you, Senator.
Oh, okay. I just wondered, where did you displace the ants to? Did you move them to your neighbors?
They weren't ants. They were more disgusting than ants. They were earwigs.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, so.
Well, depends on if you were another earwig.
They're vile, disgusting creatures, for the record.
For the record.
And they're in a pile of grass clippings that have been placed there because the grass clipping disposal bins were overflowing because my lawn is so healthy this year because of the fertilizer that I put on it. But that's, you know.
Hopefully there's no entomologists in the room. Any other questions before we let them get back to their committees? All right. Thank you very much for your hard work on this and bringing this forward, and look forward to hearing some more testimony. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, Mr. Jepson.
Hi, I'm Paul Jepson. I'm a professor at Oregon State University. I'm the...
Can you bring the microphone over to you so we make sure people can...
Yeah, I'm Paul Jepson. I'm a professor at Oregon State University. I'm the director of the Integrated Plant Protection Center, and I'm currently state IPM coordinator, which is a role that's designated by the... director of the Extension Service and the dean of the College of Agricultural Sciences. I direct an organization called the Integrated Plant Protection Center. There's about 20 of us. We're more than 75% externally funded. We only have about 5% state funds in our program, interestingly, but we spend $2 million a year at least in deploying IPM technologies and programs to benefit Oregonians. A great pleasure to be here today. I'm sorry I can't enlighten Senator Edwards further on his earwig problem because he's left, but I might mention for the good of the committee's education here that are they aware that European earwigs arrived here about a century ago or more and were explosively invasive species, and actually two city blocks in Portland were devoted to a biological control factory in the 1900s to produce little parasitic wasps that still to this day parasitize these insects and maintain them as rather rare. In fact, they're wholly beneficial. They're predators, except they sometimes end up in fruit and make us think that they're nasty pests. But in large abundance, we don't like them. But in limited numbers, they're really kind of okay and things we like to see around. So there's an interesting IPM story for you there. But what I wanted to do today, very briefly, we believe there's kind of an evidence trail that supports the need for this bill. I just wanted to enlighten you about that because with words like perfection and elegance being used, I wouldn't want you to think that this is easy. IPM is actually one of the most difficult things we do, was trying to perfect this technology and these ideas the whole time. And I just wanted to convey that briefly today. I'm going to talk about an example of how IPM is coordinated nationally, because that sheds light on why we feel this is necessary in this state. I'm going to ask if there's a good local example already of the type of thing we're proposing for state agencies that's working and providing evidence of progress. I'm going to just briefly touch on what the IPM bill sets out to do, a little bit about what kind of resources OSU can bring to bear, and whether or not OSU is prepared to invest in this if it thinks it's such a great idea. Very briefly then, IPM nationally since 2001, has been coordinated by a national committee. There are representative IPM coordinators from each state, my colleagues, as well as some federal agencies and government departments, very similar to those that would be arrayed in the committee that we're proposing. This has resulted in enormous impacts in efficiency of IPM delivery nationwide. It's built and sustained marketplaces for very valuable fruits and other horticultural products in the export marketplace, and it's dealt with some very sensitive and difficult regulatory affairs. This group set up goals and metrics just as we're deciding to do, hopefully, if this state committee is established. But it now meets once a year and has a continuously, actively functioning network. It's basically demonstrates that even at a national level, what we're proposing to do in the state has proven to be extremely effective. And we believe we'll model what we're doing and what's been achieved in the national system. Good example of IPM as it's applied is the school IPM law. The need for it actually became far more apparent after the bill was passed by the legislature a few years ago than beforehand. The success, actually, again, is dependent on partnership and communication between agencies and organizations that didn't have a vehicle for communicating before the bill was enacted. It's met all its timelines, it's developed metrics, and it's becoming a reality now rather than just a theory. At the time, if you go back through the record, you'll see that agencies and other organizations said, we're doing this already, there's no need for this bill. But actually, if you look at the bill itself, we found in a survey once the bill had been enacted that 53% of schools were reporting mice as a problem, and mice constitute the greatest asthma trigger in the US, and asthma is the biggest cause of absenteeism in our schools. Only 4% of schools at that time had an IPM plan operational. Tim Stock, my colleague behind me here in the white shirt, is the school IPM coordinator. Since 2012, 182 of 197 school districts have been trained. Model IPM plans have now been delivered. 75% of schools are now reporting use of these. 94% of them are using non-chemical methods amongst the methods they employ. And where they use chemicals, they're using very low-risk materials through a process that was developed through this bill. And you can see below this list of acronyms for the range of organizations that work actively together to benefit the health of our school children in Oregon, only as a result of having the nerve to pass a bill that initially was rather resisted, but the need for which has become highly apparent since. This bill responds to needs within agencies, as the representative mentioned. It coordinates our responses in a collaborative way to very threatening organisms. It develops metrics, which I'm sure you will all appreciate, to see progress that we make with these immensely challenging issues, and provides a mechanism for some capacity building dependent on resources that we ourselves bring in based upon our wits and the generosity of donors. It enables an exchange of ideas, and of course we can recognize excellence where it exists, because of course there are some excellent programs already within some of the agencies. And I should note here ODA, where some of the weed management programs they actually run as a state agency are exemplars internationally as the most efficient biological control programs ever developed. So we really have some things to marvel at and also some things to be concerned about. So I just wanted to touch on the final two points here. What kind of IPM resources might we bring to bear, and does the Dean think this is a good idea and a way to spend my time? Number one, by working together, we can bring in access to other networks. Here's a list of universities, federal agencies, and private weather forecasting organizations that we work with at Oregon State University to give our farmers the best pest risk predictions available, we believe, in the country. This is a nationally recognized program, and it's something we'd be able to talk about implementing within agencies where weather forecasting becomes a critical feature of pest prediction. As an example of the cleverness that lies behind this, I don't do these things, by the way. That would be inappropriate to describe myself that way. But for spotted winged Drosophila, a really nasty pest of our small fruit industries in Oregon at the moment, we really want to know why they can overwinter so well in some places. And the weather map on the left, where it's blue to purple to black, these are places that historically have had rather cold winters. The middle chart there, the map, shows you the influence of urban areas on raising the average temperatures over the winter and increasing the survival rate of these nasty little pests, such that when we look on the right-hand graph here, you can see a map that's tending to orange or red, indicating high rates of overwintering and therefore earlier attack and potential for epidemics in our fruit crops. Without these types of new technologies, which we've only been able to deploy in the last couple of years, we'd really be limited in our ability to move IPM forward in Oregon, and that's quite an exciting example, really. Farmers themselves, the blue line here, are using these tools in Oregon. You can see we've gone up to 18,000 uses of a very sophisticated modeling website for pest prediction in Oregon in the last few years. And so the idea that IPM became established or set in stone historically, and we really don't need to know that much now, is incorrect, because we've got so many more new and exciting technologies to bring to bear that can help us in our quest. We use mapping techniques, so here growers of apples and pears in the Walla Walla Basin here in Milton Freewater in Oregon share their trapping data for pests, so they only spray where the pests occur, rather than thinking if Fred down the road is spraying, they need to do it as well. So growers here are really stepping up in Oregon. We have wonderful partners in the agricultural industry, and what we're striving to do is bring this type of innovation to a broader state or a group of organizations that all themselves can share some of the great things that they're doing. I'll move on quickly from this, but this is data that shows that pesticide residues in streams in response to the programs that we offer decline very rapidly when we have years when there's a spike. And these lines here demonstrate, without me going into detail, that in the Walla Walla watershed, using the technologies I just shown you, we've been able to take some of the chemicals that need to be used, but used in an appropriate way, below concentrations that are toxic to salmon. So working cooperatively really pays off for many reasons in our state. One of the things you'll see in the future is a map of where the pests are in Oregon and where the programs are being applied to the districts of senators and representatives, so you can understand how this effort's distributed statewide. And here I've listed just some of the challenges we're talking about. We believe every Oregonian, one way or another, is affected by pest diseases and weeds, whereas it's these magnificent ecosystems we're trying to preserve and sustain for posterity, whether it's attracting tourists for hunting and fishing. $1 billion is spent on angling every year in Oregon, so that's incredibly important. Whether it's protecting agriculture or from invasive pests, or the vulnerable from pests like bedbugs, We believe there's a lot of things that we can talk about and make progress with. So to finish, our 2010 survey identified many things that we could do a little bit better on, and by cooperating and working together in a bill, through the vehicle of a committee and the process that this bill establishes, we believe that we'll be able to significantly advance IPM within our state. The Dean of Agricultural Sciences has approved the use of 10% of my time to chair this committee and support it, and has also committed to match $25,000 from the legislature, a sum which I've already sought to double through a USDA grant. So I believe the resources are there to get us started, and we're very grateful for you considering this opportunity. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you for the excellent presentation and giving us a flavor of the work that you're doing at OSU. Let's see if there's any questions for Mr. Jepson.
I could respond to Senator Hensel's question briefly.
Yes, answer my question.
Right. So my understanding is, which if there's an ODA representative here they can follow up with, is that monies are distributed by the state to the Watershed Enhancement Board, I believe it's called, and those monies are then distributed to the state weed control boards and others to enable us to manage some of these very, very pressing and significant threats. That particular program, the way in which our committee's work could potentially have an impact is by perhaps setting some parameters or best management practices if we deem that that's appropriate for the recipients of these this funding to apply. But that program in and of itself, because it's not enacted by the ODA as a state agency, rather the state provides the underlying resource, is not one that we'd be explicitly addressing. We do want to advance the practices of good weed management in Oregon, and it's certainly something we'll talk about, but that program in and of itself is not one that we'll be directly addressing. An example of a program we would address would be those that affect, for example, invasive species management, where the state has a responsibility for preventing serious new invasive threats entering the state, where technologies of mapping or trapping or novel approaches to pest management get considered at an early stage. So that's really the distinction we make in the programs we would address and those that we probably wouldn't.
But that's exactly what the weed department that is underneath the Department of Agriculture does with invasive species for weeds. They map them, they eradicate them. That is a part of the program.
And some of the technologies and ideas that they've developed could easily be shared with other agencies because they have significant expertise just as we have through the process that we're developing in this with this committee. Expertise just doesn't flow from OSU. It's brought to the chair.
I understand that. Yeah. But my question was, is what's going on in the Department of Agriculture, its weed control program, which is statutorily driven,
correct,
as are the county programs, which are in statute, is that being enfolded into House Bill 3364A?
The committee's business would not have an effect on the what the weed control boards do in the counties, other than by setting some alternative perspectives or practices that the people that carry out that program might wish to take on.
And we'll have the Department of Agriculture come up and try to address that because I think they might have a little different perspective.
Okay.
So any other questions for Mr. Jepson? Okay. Thank you very much.
I'm going
to have
everybody.
A copy of your testimony. Appreciate you coming here today to share your perspective.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And we'll call Department of Ag up after this next panel. Lisa Arkin, Angela Crowley-Koch, and Scott Dahlman. So you guys can all come up together, please. To go first.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lisa Arkin, and I'm director of Beyond Toxics. And although they've left the room, I want to give my thanks to Senator Edwards and Representative Kenny Geyer for being really models of collaboration and good legislative work. Beyond Toxics supports the passage of House Bill 3364 as amended in the version that you have. for the purpose of establishing a state integrated pest management for our state-owned facilities from public areas to resource lands. IPM is a long-standing, science-based decision-making process that identifies and reduces risks from pests and pest management strategies. IPM serves as an umbrella to coordinate the use of pest biology, environmental information, and technology to prevent the use of pest, unacceptable levels of pest damage by the most economical means while posing the least possible risk to people, property, resources, water, wildlife, and the environment. So the words I just spoke are quoted directly from the United States Department of Agriculture's prototypical document on IPM called the IPM Roadmap, which was published in 2004. When the Agricultural Agency adopted the IPM Roadmap nearly 10 years ago, it recognized that the use of pesticides requires science, planning, and metrics. When implemented correctly, IPM will then save time, money, and prevent unnecessary chemical residues in buildings and the environment. IPM originally began in the agricultural business sector. That is because it was a common sense and practical discipline that relies on science's evolving understanding of the life cycle of pests, their ability to inflict damage and economic harm, as well as considerable environmental and medical data regarding the unintended consequences of using harsh chemicals. Pest management systems are subject to constant change and must respond to uncertainty, as well as respond to the benefits of new technology. For example, unusual weather patterns may introduce new species that will require effective, coordinated, and carefully considered treatment options. Oregon needs IPM to be prepared with the best science to face the future. Another strength of House Bill 3364 is the broad scope of support it has earned. You will find medical professionals, pest control companies, people who fish and hunt, rural Oregonians, urban Oregonians, and more. Rural Oregonians stand to gain as much, if not more, from this piece of legislation because rural communities have unique pest pressures that require the best pest science available. They also have been most significantly impacted by pest management strategies. For example, in 2012, 22 rural Oregonian schools participated in the U.S. Department of Agriculture's analysis of school drinking water. And we have to remember that many rural schools get their drinking water from wells and not from a pipe coming from a treatment system. In 2012, tests of drinking water at rural schools revealed the presence of pesticides in 50% of the school's waters. The detection of these pesticides suggests that chemicals are getting into groundwater that is being used by children for drinking. The schools were located in various locations across the state, including Ontario, Corvallis, Brookings, Benn, Molalla, and Molino. The scope of House Bill 3364's applies only to state-owned property and not to private land or commercial pest control companies' businesses. Yet it is the industry standard. You have before you a letter from a pest control company, one of the biggest in the state, that also contracts at times to the Department of Administrative Services, and I quote them, "The state of Oregon would be well served by adopting IPM as the standard for pest treatment because of the realized efficiencies, cost effectiveness, and risk reductions over time. IPM saves money, limits the possibility of human exposure to pesticides, and in this writer's experience, is more successful." So in closing, our state agencies already spend a lot of dollars in pest control efforts. That reason is because we will have pests. It's an ongoing problem, and we will have the ongoing challenge of utilizing the most effective and least harmful of control strategies and using the best science. So with the help of this bill, Oregon will stay up to date on the science of controlling pests. We'll use the funds we're already spending most effectively be able to respond to the needs and concerns of the public, and for state agencies adopt a professional, systematic, and verifiable method of pest control. It is the policy that citizens and governments alike can be proud to support. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Lisa. Whoever wants to go next?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Angela Crowley-Cook. I'm the Legislative Director at Oregon Environmental Council. Oregon Environmental Council supports HB 3364A, which will maximize effective, sustainable pest management here in Oregon. Oregon is lucky because we're home to this nationally renowned center, as you heard, at OSU, the Integrated Plant Protection Center, and we should really take advantage of this great resource that we have in Oregon, and HB 3364 is really a great next step. The state agencies are doing some work on IPM now, and this will enhance their ability to really maximize the tools, the training, and the expertise that comes out of OSU. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And last, Scott.
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Scott Dahlman. I'm the Executive Director of Oregonians for Food and Shelter. As a reminder, we're a grassroots organization representing farmers, foresters, and other pesticide users on issues involving pesticides, fertilizer, and biotechnology. I'm here today in support of the amended version of House Bill 3364. While we had some significant concerns with the original language of the bill, I have to thank Representative Kenny Geyer for bringing together a broad group of stakeholders to really put serious work into the language to greatly improve it, and it has been improved. Now, we support the amended version because OFS has historically and continues to support the idea of integrated pest management, but we must ensure that all the tools are available when they are needed in any integrated pest management program. We also support that the implementing agencies should gather on a regular basis and discuss the newest developments within integrated pest management so they can share the knowledge that they've gained by implementing this program. The most crucial part of the legislation for us is the IPM definition, which is changed in this bill from the current definition. I want to make it clear that we think that the current definition is sufficient, but if it is going to be changed, we are comfortable with the language that's been developed through the stakeholder process on this. So with that, I just want to reiterate that we are in support of the amended version of the bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Thank you all for your testimony. Any questions? Okay. It's not often that we're speechless up here. So.
Will you quit bugging us about questions?
I just think that maybe folks aren't paying attention if they're not asking questions.
Senator Olson just said I want to be a pest.
Oh, didn't get that one. Okay, why don't we have the Department of Agriculture come up and try to answer Senator Hansel's question, and then we'll see if there's anybody else that wants to testify in this bill. But I think that's it for signed up.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Lisa Hansen, Deputy Director with the Oregon Department of Agriculture. So I'm going to rephrase what I thought I heard you say, Senator Hansel, if that's okay, and then respond. I think your question was, how will this bill impact the Oregon Department of Agriculture's weed control program? I'm getting a nod, so yes. So currently, Oregon law requires state agencies to use IPM, and that's been around for quite some time. Back in the 80s, there was an integrated pest management committee. ODA was part of that. ODA chaired that. It was actually within our statutes. At some point in the late 90s, it was determined that the committee thought its work was done, and so that committee was eliminated, and then the Invasive Species Council took its place. So what House Bill 3364 does allows us to continue to do the work that we have been. And if you look at the definition of IPM in this bill, it very, very closely mirrors the definition of integrated weed management that we currently use. So the agency has been using IPM in its programs, will continue to use it. What this does is allow us to gain expertise, share expertise, and develop metrics so that we can measure and show progress. And that's one of the challenges we've had as we've talked about using IPM in our programs. We really haven't had great metrics to be able to tell that story. And so there'll be some additional work with the metrics part of it, but if that helps you.
Follow up. I just want to make sure we weren't reinventing the wheel for the weed program, because I think a lot of work and energy has been put into it. It's in statute. It's probably the first of this kind of pest control in Oregon, and I just didn't want it to be, you know, forgotten or brought into something that maybe wouldn't be as effective or duplicated.
Madam Chair, Senator Hansel, this just continues the work that we have been doing.
Sounds good.
Okay. Any other questions for the department while we have her up here? And I heard you mention as far as, because we now have the Invasive Species Council as well, and so making sure that there's communication and coordination. And I saw Lisa Duber-Kara's name up there. So, yeah, making sure that we're communicating and coordinating is very important. And I'm assuming that you'll make sure that happens, and so will Mr. Jepson. And we certainly don't have an abundance of staff available to duplicate efforts either, as you know. So, all right, thank you very much. With that, is there anybody else who would like to testify in House Bill 3364A? Seeing none, we'll go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 3364A. We're going to hear the next bill will be House Bill 3491A, because we have several representatives, senators that would like to testify on that, or a few.
Order again?
Yeah. So we're going to we will open up a public hearing on House Bill 3491A. Beth, if you can provide us with an overview.
Madam Chair and committee members, House Bill 3491A, there's a no revenue or fiscal impact on this bill. It requires the governor to report to the Legislative Assembly regarding the status of the Columbia River Treaty review, as well as on any participation or input the governor or any state agency has included, and it declares an emergency effective upon passage.
Okay, thank you, Beth. We'll have Representative Benson, Senator Whitsitt, if you want to come up together. Show solidarity between the House and the Senate. Thank you, gentlemen, for your patience. And whoever wants to go first.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Cliff Benz, District 60. This bill is intended to offer the governor the chance to come in and explain how the negotiations or discussions regarding the Columbia River Treaty are going. And, of course, the hope is that he would be bringing that report to us on the dates I've called out or we've called out in the bill. The reason for this, of course, is because, actually, I'm looking at an article out of the Oregonian from just a few days ago, which calls out the fine print in the treaty. The treaty expires in 2024, but requests for revisions or renewal must be made 10 years in advance, which is now. By December of this year, Oregon and Northwest Managers of the River, the BPA and the U.S. Corps of Engineers, in consultation with the 15 Northwest Tribes and others, must tell the U.S. State Department what to do. And so that's December of this year. And the importance of what this treaty is about is hard to overstate. And so the negotiations and the type of issues that are being brought before this state need to be expressed to us in the legislature for a number of reasons. One, the other states are heavily involved in this, Montana, Idaho, Washington. And I have to say, I was looking at the memo from Water Resources dated November 15th of 12, looking at it right now, in fact, and there's a statement, one of the recommended actions to help ensure Oregon can meet its in-stream and out-of-stream water needs is described in Goal 2 of Oregon's Integrated Water Resource Strategy is to partner with federal agencies, tribes, and neighboring states in long-term water resources management. I don't like the word partner very much when I'm talking about water, because one person either gets it and the other person doesn't. That's kind of how water works. And so in this challenging negotiation, the issue is, how do we make sure Oregon, through its partnering with these other folks, doesn't end up losing that which it needs so much for its future? And I'm okay with the word in the general sense, but I'm not when it comes to negotiating this most important treaty. The gives and takes in this deal are huge, and they are in the billions of dollars. The next treaty will be, of course, I think 50 years in length if we have another one. And it's the kind of thing that deserves every bit of attention we can give it. I am sure that the governor would look forward to, and it already has been, reporting to us. This is not the type of thing that is helped by being negotiated in secret. It's the type of thing that needs to be explained and called out so that we as a state understand what's happening. Because this future is all of ours. And I really did like the Oregonian's article. They call out, or it calls out, the incredible need to pay attention and see what's going to happen to us. They do mention the euphemistic use of the phrase ecological benefit, ecosystem benefits, which of course means that to the extent we choose to leave more water in the river, we will pay for it elsewhere. And it's extremely important we know those costs. I'm hoping that the future memos and things that we see talk a little more about my side of the state, next to and adjacent to the Snake River. I don't see that in many of the materials I have here before me. It's pretty darn important little stream, and it needs to be taken into account by our state in these negotiations. It's certainly a part of the Columbia system. And to the extent that we plan on taking more water out or using water for other purposes in the Columbia, the Snake will most assuredly be an important part of those discussions. I can assure you Idaho knows this, and they are at that table aggressively defending Idaho's interests. I am absolutely sure that, subject, Madam Chair, to whatever adjustments need to be made on the dates, that we as a legislature need to be listening carefully to that which the governor is working so hard, I am sure, for us on. And with that, I'm not really the right one to ask questions about this, other than to say I've been involved off and on in it for many years, and I'm looking forward to hearing how well the governor is doing in protecting the state's interests.
Thank you, Representative. We'll hear from the senator first and then see if there's any questions for either of you.
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Senator Doug Whitsett, representing District 28. The Columbia River Treaty is critical to every Oregonian. The treaty makes possible flood control, shipping, hydroelectric generation, irrigation, fisheries, and untold other recreational opportunities. Let me explain just one nuance of the treaty. Under the current agreement, the preponderance of water stored for flood control occurs in Canada. The water is released in Canada after the peak flow season in order to modulate the river flow and prevent flooding downstream in the United States. The current agreement, requires that a portion of the electricity generated in the United States, when that water stored for flood control is released, be returned to Canada free of charge. The United States would be required to manage their own flood control in the event that the Canadian government decided to end the treaty, build their own hydroelectric generating facilities, and use their stored water to generate more electricity. Managing our own system of flood control would require nearly complete changes in how the Columbia River flow is managed. The required changes would drastically alter all of the attributes that make the Columbia River system so invaluable to Oregonians. For instance, shipping on the river could be reduced or even seasonally eliminated by the new requirements to hold the reservoir pools at low level for flood control. Hydroelectric generation could be drastically reduced in certain seasons due to the required changes in reservoir pool management. Using the river water for irrigation could be made technically and financially infeasible in many locations along the river due to the required changes in reservoir pool levels. The entire fishery management paradigm would require significant and permanent changes in order to continue to protect threatened and endangered species. And treaties with sovereign tribes might need to be renegotiated due to changes in river flow. For those reasons and myriad other reasons, House Bill 3191A is critically important to every Oregonian. It is fitting and proper for the governor to serve as the point in these negotiations. It is equally fitting and proper that the Oregon legislature is kept up to speed on these negotiations that are so vital to all Oregonians. I urge your unanimous support of House Bill 3191A. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any questions for the Senator or Representative? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we have one person signed up to testify on this, Peggy Lynch from the League of Women Voters. Anybody else would like to testify on House Bill 3491A? Peggy.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. The League of Women Voters is a nonpartisan grassroots political organization that encourages informed and active participation in government. And there is no place more when this is more important than this treaty. The League first studied water issues and adopted positions in 1969. We did it in 77, 85, 2001. In 1979, we focused on water resources of the Columbia River and the Columbia River Task Force. We are currently following the Columbia River Treaty 2014 review, and we have a volunteer specifically assigned to this important matter and have provided input already into that process. We are working with the leagues of Montana, Idaho, and Washington to raise public awareness and to participate in the opportunities available. We recognize the importance of the treaty to Oregon, and you have just heard that from the two representatives, and encourage the legislature to adopt 3491A. We're aware that the Water Resources Department is assigned staff to this treaty, and the Water Resources Commission receives regular reports, so the requirement to report regularly is no burden to the department. And in fact, the League believes it is imperative that the legislature be kept informed, because involvement by the legislature and the governor to assure that the State Department follows up and actively participates in this treaty on behalf of the United States is critical to Oregon. Regular reports to this body will help raise public awareness around this important issue. So we ask that you move this bill quickly and urgently, and begin the discussion with others to make sure that everyone understands how important this treaty is to Oregon. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Peggy. Any questions? Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you for your testimony. Seeing that nobody else is here to testify on House Bill 3491A, we will go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 3491A. Open up a public hearing on House Bill 2025A. Beth?
Madam Chair and committee members, House Bill 2025A, it makes a person liable to an owner for resulting economic damage if a person owns or possesses bison running at large or uncontrolled upon open land. There's a -A7 amendment in your packet, and the -A7 amendment makes a person allowing livestock to run at large subject to a reduced maximum penalty of a Class D violation if the person makes all required appearances, evidence does not establish a person acted intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly, and that a person does not have previous conviction for allowing livestock to run at large.
Yes, so we, you probably see that this looks familiar to everybody. Did you explain it?
You've actually had a conversation about both of these measures. The Senate bill, while we were hearing Senate Bill 287 that Senator Boquist brought in front of you that you passed out is in the House committee, and House Bill 2025, which you heard testimony on, a separate measure that the relating to clause didn't fit for a gentleman on the bison bill that needed to be placed into a relating to clause that would work in the House. So now that concept's come back. The issue with that we're faced with here is that the two statutes or the two bills are amending the same statute, and so the -A7 amendment was requested to incorporate Senate Bill 287, which is currently in the House, so that they just are integrated into the statute in a manner that doesn't conflict.
Okay. So I think with that, we do not have anybody signed up to testify. So we had invited Senator Close and Senator Boquist, and both of them said they're fine with the bill. Department of Agriculture, did you want to come up and say anything on the record? Okay. So anybody would like to testify on this bill, House Bill 2025?
Can I ask questions then?
Sure.
Thank you for testifying.
Yeah. You can ask questions of the committee staff, and if we need to have Department of Agriculture come up, we can.
I just asked the question that if how big does the fence have to be to hold these bison in? Because if there's a lightning storm that scares them, what do we have to do?
A concrete wall?
this would be typical of any cow or whatever he was. Sorry, Lisa.
For the record, Lisa Hansen, Deputy Director with the Oregon Department of Agriculture. Chair Dingfelder, Senator Olson, first of all, I am not an expert on fencing for bison, but this is what I understand, that the fencing for bison needs to be much stronger, and it's much more complicated than that we're used to having for livestock, cows and horses. They won't respect the normal fencing wire. And so this clearly makes it the responsibility of the bison owner to build a fence that will keep their bison in, whether they are on open range or in a protected district.
Do you have a follow-up?
If they're on open range, then why would they be fenced?
It doesn't, Chair Dingfelder, Senator Olson, it doesn't allow them to be out on open range. Says they have to be, if you own bison,
you have to contain
your bison.
Yeah. It's basically what the bill says.
Yeah.
I could answer this question, too. Yeah. The bison growers in our area have railroad ties with usually 2x10s spiked into them to provide the fencing. And for the most part, it works pretty good. You can do it, but it's a different kind of fence.
What about water buffalo, then? Because there is a gentleman in the state that raises water buffalo. Isn't that not correct?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Olson, you're correct. There is a gentleman that raises water buffalo, I believe, in Clackamas County.
Mm-hmm. Probably in your district.
Yeah, right? I was going to say, would this apply to your constituents?
No,
I
don't want
to
go
to
Asian or African.
Okay.
Asian are a problem, but Africans can be really nasty.
Yeah, really.
Any other questions for the department?
You, thank you, appreciate that.
Okay, seeing none, and nobody is here to testify on the bill. Thank you, Lisa, for coming up. We'll go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2025A. We're going to go ahead and open up some work sessions. So we're just going to go through and start with a work session on House Bill 2252. Beth, you want to remind us what this bill is? We heard it a couple of sessions ago.
Madam Chair, House Bill 2252, there's a revenue statement issued and a minimal fiscal impact statement, no statement issued, authorizes the Fish and Wildlife Commission to establish multi-year licenses, allows issuing agents to charge certain fees, and provides that non-resident members of uniformed services are residents for purchases of certain license tags and permits.
Okay, we are in a work session. I will entertain a motion.
Madam Chair, I move that House Bill 2252 be reported out of committee with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Olson moves House Bill 2252 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion about this measure? Okay, seeing none, the clerk will call the roll, please.
Senator Bates.
Aye.
Senator Hansel.
Aye.
Senator House.
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson.
Aye.
Chair
Dingfelder. Aye. With that,
I'm carrying.
I was going to say, you're carrying all the bills. Are you sure you don't want to share the wealth a little bit?
No, I like this one.
Okay. With that, we'll close the works. The motion carries.
Yeah.
We'll close the work session, and Senator Olson will carry the bill. Okay, we'll open up a public hearing on House Bill 2893A. Beth, if you can provide. Remind us of what the bill does.
Madam Chair, House Bill 2893A is no revenue and a minimal fiscal impact, no statement issued. It increases the volumetric incentive rate pilot program by 2.5 megawatts to 27.5, and it closes the pilot program to new applicants on March 31st, 2016.
Okay. I will take a motion.
Madam Chair, I move that House Bill 2893A be reported out of committee with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, House Bill 2893A, Senator Bates moves House Bill 2893A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Yes, Madam Chair. I looked at this bill over and over and talked to many people about it and realized that with the energy work group that I had put together last summer, that it kind of does not meet some of the tenets that we came up with in our energy proposals. And those would be Oregon's energy policy should strive to ensure that energy will be affordable for all customers Oregon's energy policy should treat ratepayers as ratepayers, not taxpayers. And Oregon's energy policy should implement policies or programs that create an equal playing field for Oregon businesses in a competitive world market, resulting in positive impacts on the citizens of the state and no loss in jobs. So with those three, I don't think I can support this bill.
Okay. I don't think we heard any testimony about loss of jobs or the other, but whatever. If anything, this is actually promoting jobs because we're trying to make sure that the program continues to run, which is, I think we heard about installation of for solar panels, and that was actually creating jobs. But, so noted for the record. Okay, there's a motion on the table. Any other discussion?
We in work session?
We're in work session. Do you want to have somebody come up?
I thought you went into a public hearing.
No, we did a public hearing.
No, but are you sure you're in work session?
Can you just say yes, we are in work session.
Yeah.
Seth up. That's where we were. We're going to vote.
I said work session. Any other further discussion or questions? Okay, clerk will call the roll, please.
Senator Bates.
Aye.
Senator Hansel.
Aye.
Senator House.
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson.
No.
Chair Dingfelder.
Aye. With that, the motion carries, and I will carry that to the floor since I've been following the feed-in tariff program or whatever we're calling it now, the volumetric program for quite a while. With that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2893A. Go ahead and open up a work session on House Bill 3103A. Beth?
Madam Chair and committee members, House Bill 3103A has a no revenue and a minimal fiscal impact statement. The measure would require oil spill plans for facilities exporting petroleum to a ship while excluding smaller scale facilities like marinas or public fueling stations.
Okay. We are in a work session for House Bill 3103A. I will take a motion.
Madam Chair, I move that House Bill 3103A be reported out of committee with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Senator also moves House Bill 3103A be reported out of committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay, seeing none, the clerk will call the roll, please.
Senator Bates.
Aye.
Senator Hansel.
Aye.
Senator House.
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson.
Aye.
Chair Dingfelder.
Aye. That the motion carries, and anybody want to volunteer for oil spills?
That's a slick question.
Senator House, because he's slick, he will carry it. Okay, with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 3103A, and we'll open up a work session on House Bill 3301A. Beth?
Madam Chair and committee members, House Bill 3301A, for the record, this measure authorizes that an owner of a lot in a planned community or unit in a condominium shall install and use electric vehicle charging can install or use electric vehicle charging stations. There's a proposed -A3 amendment in front of you that Harrison Conley from Legislative Council came and discussed during the hearing, which stipulates that a Class 1 or Class 2 planned community that was created prior to January 1, 2002 would be subject to the Act authorizing the owner to install and use the charging stations. There's a no revenue impact and a no fiscal impact on that -A3 amendment.
Okay. Does everyone have the -3 amendment in front of them, or it is also on OLIS?
And in the back of the room, Madam Chair.
Yes. Thank you. And thank you, Beth. I do recall that discussion, and the amendment was requested by the proponent of the bill. Is that correct?
Correct, Madam Chair.
Okay. It's not one that I specifically requested or any members of the committee, I don't think. Does anybody have any questions about this amendment? Otherwise, I'll take a motion.
Did you have a question?
Beth and I were talking earlier today for a second, and I tried to look it up, couldn't find it. If someone installs this, so if a group of homeowners say we want this installed, they go through all the architecture and everything, get everything done, who actually owns the station, who actually pays for the station? Beth, do you know the answer to that?
Madam Chair and committee members, so the measure lays out that the owner of the charging station is responsible for all of the costs associated with the installation and use of the charging station.
Who is the owner of the? Is the individual asked for it, or is it the owner of the?
we could maybe call legislative council, but they are responsible to disclose that the person installing it, the owner of the condominium, would be responsible for disclosure to a prospective buyer. So once they went to sell their condo.
The person who lives in the condo owns it.
Well, it depends. It could be the condo. Yeah, I'm assuming the condo. Okay. But I don't know if we have anybody here from Department of Energy that can maybe answer that. No? Because the other would be you could have it contracted out. You could have somebody come and install it, and then the folks who were, they'd own it, and then the folks who are using the energy would pay for it or pay for the installation cost. So it depends.
I just got to thinking about that because when I saw the cost of one of these stations, I wanted to be kind of clear in my mind we're voting for it.
So we could either.
I don't want to hold this up. We'll run it through.
Okay. I was going to say we can either hold it over and do the work session next time if you want to get the answers to that,
I'll
or we could
out.
Call and. You know, yeah. I'm sure we can get you the answer.
It's bad, though.
Huh?
What happens if it's bad?
We can kill it on the floor in broad daylight.
Okay, so I will then take a motion for the 8-A3 amendments.
Chair Dingfelder, I move to adopt the -A3 amendments dated 5-6-2013.
Okay, Senator Olson moves to adopt the -A3 amendments dated 5-6-2013. Is there any discussion?
I think Senator Bates raises a very good question. I'd like to know the answer to that, too. I'll vote for it now.
Well, we could recess.
I'm okay with following his lead, but, you know, it might get to the floor.
Well, why don't we just recess for a minute and see if we can call the drafter, because we may be able to get the answer.
It's kind of vague in my mind who ends up owning it and responsible for it.
We'll go ahead and recess for a minute.
Right.
So, Shelley, you can turn off the... Okay, we'll unrecess our work session on House Bill 3301A. Do you want to come up, Joe, and put something on the record?
You can get us clarified here.
That's a mess. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Joe Esmond, business agent for the IBW 48, who's been involved in the EV movement for many years because it has electrons in it, and that's what we do. I am not an attorney for any HOAs or anything else. Quickly, this is one of the markets that's been trying to be hit by the EV people. We have the public stuff. We have your homeowners. And now we want to go into the condominiums. It would be installed by a licensed electrician. And you have probably two options. One is owned by the person or else it's leased to the person by the manufacturer of the charging device. So very quickly, that's about it. It's a lot of it can be put in within maybe a half hour to an hour, say in your house. Mm-hmm. It's the same circuit that you use for a stove or a dryer. It's 220.
So I think the question was, so if you had a charger that was being shared at a condominium, and then the question is, would it be owned by the condominium?
That's above my pay grade.
Okay.
Way
so which, I think that
that's
was your question, Senator Bates, correct?
Yeah, that was the question.
Here it comes.
Yeah, curiosity. I thought some of these were 440s.
As long as he's up here and you're talking about electricity.
Yeah.
You know, there's loads with all the condominiums. They all have a load. Now, what happens if the load, charging load, would exceed the transformer capability?
It's the same load as it would be for your dryer.
Right, but panels.
And each condo has their own panel, and most of those panels are way oversized when installed.
You'd have to add a lot of chargers in order.
Most panels are 200 amp.
Right, and most houses maybe unless you have three big TVs and pool and everything else.
Well, the senator said that he thought these were 440 volt chargers.
Madam Chair. Members of the committee.
So they're 220s.
Yeah, I didn't know. It
would be 220. 440 or 480 volts is a 1 hour charge, and that's a lot of. It's like putting the paddles on you.
Some of the literature we got said 440 is on.
That's, those are the rapid charges, like.
And that's three phase, and that's very expensive. Right. So the average homeowner or condo owner is.
Yeah, they are expensive. They've listed them like $10,000.
Right. So. Most of the average homeowner, my understanding is they'd have 220s.
So
I know because we.
If you're just going to put it, if the condo owner's going to own it, why does they have to have this bill? Can they just do it? I mean, they're on the condo.
I think it was about who the.
They're tied into the whole
right,
thing.
Right, because not all condominium residents are going to want to pay the fee. So this is to allow the folks who want the charging station to pay the fee through their condominium. So why don't we have Ledge Council come on up? Harrison?
Thank you for your time.
Thank you for
thank you.
Jumping
I hope
in.
I didn't. Muddle it too much?
Yeah. Not too much.
Thanks.
Thank you, sir. Thank you,
Doug. Good afternoon. Harrison Connolly, Chief Senior Deputy Legislative Counsel.
And Harrison, the question was, Senator Bates asked who would own the charging facility, and it wasn't specified in the bill. Why don't you go ahead and read the...
Well, it might have been. I might have missed it. This, you know.
No.
Madam Chair, I was just conferring with Harrison on site. Mm-hmm. I think he's on track.
Okay. Why don't you go for it, Harrison?
Well, Chair Diegenfelder, I'm sorry, who asked the question? Senator.
It was Senator Bates.
Oh, Senator Bates.
Yeah.
Good afternoon,
I'm sorry.
Sir.
frankly,
you do have me a little bit here. Let's start with the planned communities because I think that's a little bit easier. I believe in the planned community side, we have allowed the placement of these devices in areas under the exclusive use and occupancy of the owner. So I believe that is being developed on the private property of the owner of a home in a planned community. In the condominium area, that may be a little bit different, and I can't give you a definitive answer here today. I'd like to tell you where I think we're going and then come back to you with a clearer answer. We're allowing these in a condo in a space assigned to the unit and used for parking or storage of autos and trucks and boats, or in a limited common element. A limited common element would be an area that's reserved for a group of the condos. So there would be, that is in some way or other shared by, say, you know, four units. Maybe it could be a backyard area that's shared by a group of the condominiums. The space for parking. Again, that strikes me as probably, in fact, part of the condo's common space that's assigned to them. So it may be that it depends on the placement of the unit in a condominium, whether the person actually owns it or whether it becomes a limited common element. But like I say, I think what I really need to do is to try to go back and do a little research on this and try to come back with a better answer for you, a clearer answer.
So the way that I'm reading right now on page 3, now this is, though, the original bill.
Page 3 would be the one that applies to
right.
the planned
so
community.
It says the owner. An owner may install an electric vehicle charging station. So
an owner is the defined term for the owner of a lot in a planned community. So that is the homeowner. And as I say, in that case, we are putting it on property that is specifically the homeowner's property.
Okay. Senator, Representative Barnhart is here.
Oh, good. We got him.
Yeah, we'll see if you can answer this. I think Senator Bates is trying to stump the LC drafter on this one. So, Senator Bates, why don't you reiterate your question?
Here's what I'm trying to get to.
We're in a work session, and we're recessed, or we have just put on hold the motion right now. But go ahead, Senator Bates. Why don't you re-ask your question?
We're all in favor of the bill, so let's start there. But we, what was not clear to us, or to me at least, and I probably shouldn't have said anything, is in a situation where people are living in a condominium, and it's in a, some kind of a common space for that condominium, who actually owns the charging station? Can the condominium association own it? Does the individual who's going to use it the most own it? It's just kind of vague. Maybe
or does it by depend?
Rule. Or does it depend? Maybe you do it by rule afterwards, but it seems to be some vagueness there. I'm just waiting for someone to run over the top of it and wreck it, or somebody gets hurt and you know, a lawsuit, and then who's gets sued and for what and why and all that.
Well, we're
kind of
lucky because Representative Barnhart is also an attorney, so he can.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Bates. My name is Phil Barnhart. I'm the state representative from House District 11. I think you've raised some very good questions around this issue. The intent of this bill is to require a homeowners association to allow an owner to install a charger, even if they don't want to. And that's all the bill really does. It does require that it does allow, and there's a number of things that it allows, that in effect the homeowners association has to act reasonably in its agreement with the owner who wants to make this installation. The reason for writing the language that way, and this comes right out of the California bill that does the same thing, or the law that does the same thing, the reason for doing it that way is that circumstances are very different in different places. And what I think will happen in this, if a bill like this is adopted by the legislature, is that homeowners associations and owners who want to install electric vehicle chargers will realize that they have to analyze the situation that they're in and reach agreements that will get to the needs of both. Now, let me just give you an example of what I'm talking about. If you have a situation in which the parking belongs to the is part of the common area or the area which is assignable to individuals. I'm assigned a parking space, but I don't own it. An easy solution for this sort of situation would be to move some of the people around so that the parking for the electric vehicle charger is somewhere near the electric room for the site, so it can be installed that way. But then I think that you'd want to reach an agreements over who actually owned the electric charger, who is responsible for maintaining it, and who is responsible for paying electricity. These seem to me to be all part of the reasonable parts of a contract that would be signed. The only thing that the contract can't say, or that the homeowners association cannot do, is tell you that you can't install one somehow, some way, but acting reasonably. Now, I can perceive that the situation in which it's not possible to install one because there simply isn't a way to do it, or it's so expensive to do it that nobody's going to want to. But the bill doesn't say you have to install it anyway. It just says that the homeowners association has to act reasonably. And then it also indicates a number of things that the homeowners association absolutely can do, like requiring that you comply with their architectural design guidelines and those kinds of things. And of course, those things are enumerated in here. But one of the reasons it's not more specific is that every circumstance is different. In the case of my installation in Portland, in the condominium that we have there, because this parking space belongs to us, it's part of the owner's exclusive use property. And of course, all the other spaces belong to other people in the space. I don't have the option of suggesting, gee, maybe we just switch me with somebody else. We had to run a long conduit through the common area, and the way we did that was to run it along the ceiling. The agreement that I made with the condominium association, or with the homeowners association, was they would allow me to do that. They would allow me to tie into the electrical system and install a separate meter so that they could tell how much I was using and billing for it. But they also included provisions that said, I was responsible for maintaining it. If there was a problem with it, they could require me to take it out. If I moved and sold the space, they could require me to take it out. Those were all part of the agreements that we reached as a part of this. The only thing this bill would do in addition to that is say to them, you have to work toward an agreement with the homeowner. That's all. And so because circumstances are so different, I think spelling out in greater detail would be extremely difficult in a bill like this, which I think is why California came up with the agreement that they came up with. We did inquire to find out, are there problems with the California bill? We haven't heard of any. It seems that this is working. Now, in other kinds of situations like Sun River, for example, or places like that where people have detached homes for the most part and their own carport or their own garage, this stuff becomes very easy. You still may have to get the condo, the homeowners association, to agree to allow you to install additional electrical service to the building because there may not be enough. And so that may be the part that they play in that. But it's going to be different for every installation.
So, Senator, does that answer your question? Because we're about to lose a member here, and we are in a work session. So,
probably should have brought it up, but it struck me strange, so I'll stop there.
Well, Chair Dingfelder, Senator Bates, I'd like to say, I think in the situation I heard Representative Barnhart describe, it sounds like a fixture on his property. I'm going to suggest he owns it.
Mm-hmm. That was my question, Representative Barnhart. Do you own that?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Hansel. Yes, I do own it, but I'm only allowed to keep it under certain circumstances, okay. And that's part of the agreement we made.
If installed in a limited common element, that might muddy the water about the ownership of the fixture.
Right, and I think the way this, if I could, Madam Chair, the reason that what this bill does, I think, is that if it's in a limited common element, I have to get agreement from the other people who have rights to that limited common element.
Okay.
So that wasn't the case in my situation.
If I'm hearing right, the reason it wasn't spelled out exactly who owns it, because it may depend in different circumstances.
I think the big question is when you have a common space, what do you do with it? So.
Okay, so we are in a work session. Well,
Madam Chair, can I ask the representative one question?
Sure.
On page 3, line 42, it says, a homeowners association may not prohibit installation or use of a charging station installed and used in compliance with the requirements of the section. You had just mentioned earlier that you're supposed to negotiate and work this out.
Right.
And this says they absolutely can't prohibit it.
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Olson, that's exactly what the bill's intended to do.
Right.
That's the key line of the bill. Is that it requires a homeowners association to allow it, but it also requires that that they are allowed to require an application, that they're allowed to require that that the application be based on a reasonable request, that the owner of the charging station is responsible for all the things that are listed on page 4, starting in line 9, and so forth. And the way I read the language here, it intends that they are required to act reasonably in complying with this agreement. Now, as I said earlier, I think there are probably situations in which it isn't possible to do this, or if it is done, it would be at such a high expense that the applicant would abandon the application because the applicant is required to pay for it.
Follow up? Mm-hmm. Then you brought another question up. It says that the community shall approve the application within 60 days unless the delay in approving the application is based on a reasonable request for additional information. What happens if it doesn't meet the architectural standards? Then this bill makes them approve it.
Actually, if I could, Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I think there's a specific requirement that they have to meet. I'm trying to find it here. Do you see it?
I think my computer died, so I'd have to pull over here.
Yes, but the requirement for architectural, for meeting architectural standards.
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Olson, I believe that we have given the Homeowners Association authority to reject one of these if the owner refuses to comply with the architectural standards.
Yeah, I'm trying to find the language.
I believe that would not be in compliance with this section.
I'm trying to find the language in the bill. There is specific language in the bill that
it's the last two lines on page 3, 44 and 45.
Yes. So the owner has to submit an application, and they may require the charging station to meet architectural standards of the planned community. So if you don't do that.
I understand that, yeah. But it says that they shall approve it within 60 days. So that the
in compliance with this section.
Right. If I could, Madam Chair, Senator Olson, when you're reading a statute like this, you read all the sections together.
Right.
And so if there's a specific language here that says they may require the station to meet architectural standards, then they can require that, regardless of what something else says.
You think so?
Oh, no question at all in my mind.
We've got LC right
here. That's exactly why we have lawyers, isn't it, to figure those things out.
That's right.
And maybe that's a better question for LC to answer than me. I think you have to read the whole bill together.
All I'd like to do is see the line that says that if the application doesn't meet their requirements, they don't have to put it in, or they won't be allowed to put it in. Just show me where that's at. It's not that it's not a bad idea.
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Olson, I would not argue that this is my most elegant work, but I'm going to basically agree with the way Representative Barnhart has construed it. I think if you look at page 3, the last two lines there, 44 and 45, it says that the homeowners association may require that the facility meet architectural standards.
So if they don't
I think
require
that is an
it,
out
they,
for them.
Yeah, that's the out
and,
for
and,
them.
And if I could, Madam Chair, my view of the application is that the application is not complete until it does comply with the architectural standards. That's the way I've read this bill right along, and therefore they don't have a completed application. They don't have anything to approve.
Except that you have two lines in there. One says you cannot prohibit the installation, and the other one says you shall approve that application within 60 days.
Cannot.
And nothing in there says that if it doesn't meet the criteria, then they don't have to approve it until it does meet the criteria.
Right.
Is there anything in the bill that says that? That's my only question. That says if they do not meet the criteria, then the homeowners association does not have to approve it until it either meets the criteria, the person that wants to put it in that decides not to put it in, or they meet the criteria.
I guess the way that I read it, it's implied in that construction. You're the drafter, so
Chair
I guess
Dinkfelder, that's... Chair Dinkfelder, Senator Olson, the wording you mentioned does not appear in the bill, but the first line that you quoted part of it. A homeowners association may not prohibit installation or use of a charging station installed and used in compliance with the requirements
of
this section.
So if they're not in compliance, that's the
next,
the way I
the
read it.
The two lines below, it says that the homeowners association may require the charging station to meet architectural standards. If an owner is not willing to meet the architectural standards, it doesn't meet the requirements of this section.
Not in
Boy,
compliance.
I'm not a lawyer, but I'm gonna vote for this bill. I'm not a lawyer, but I think that looks like a wonderful lawsuit.
Right.
Not my most elegant language. I would agree I could do better.
Okay, well, so in the essence of time, do you want to have the last word on this, Representative?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I simply would note that we heard from a number of condominium associations. They asked us to, actually they asked us to expand this bill. I decided not to. If a condominium association wants to agree that it ought to have commercial chargers around their commercial areas, they can agree to that without the assistance of the state.
This is the one we're on, right?
The only purpose of this bill, the only purpose of this bill is to deal with homeowners associations that don't want these charger things around their place. That's all.
Okay, so we have a motion on the table to adopt the dash A3 amendments. Why don't I have the clerk call the roll just so we're clear.
Yes.
Senator Hansel.
Aye.
Senator
Hounds. Aye.
Vice Chair Olson.
Aye.
Aye. With that, the amendment is adopted, and I will take a motion for the entire bill.
Chair Dinkfelder, I move House Bill 3301A as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Olson moves House Bill 3301A as amended with the dash threes to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Any further discussion?
I think the good Senator Bates.
Oh, I know.
We've been waiting here half an hour.
All in favor?
Okay, so shall I please call the roll?
Senator Bates.
I have to carry it then. Yeah, I'll say yes.
Senator Hansel.
Aye.
Senator House.
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson.
Aye.
Chair Dinkfelder.
Aye. And that the motion carries, and Senator Bates has volunteered to be the carrier.
Get him.
With that, the work session is closed. And Beth, anything else for the good of the order?
Adam,
we are adjourned. Great minds think alike, Senator. That's exactly what I was thinking.